This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
One thing that really struck me that I'd like to hear a little bit more about in terms of this piece, which I obviously don't know yet, but this notion of extraordinary rendition that you mentioned in the program notes was kind of an interesting, both sort of politicized and sort of aestheticized idea relating to this notion of borrowing and collecting and, in your words, stealing artifact, musical and sonic artifact over time, that I thought was sort of an interesting spin and brought what is a very lengthy and extensive sort of area of practice over the 20th century into a very contemporary sort of political and critical context. I thought it would be great to hear a bit more about your thoughts on that issue, just to start things off.
Well, first of all, I don't think that it's limited, the idea of stealing and theft, artistic theft in particular, or artistic borrowing, or appropriation, as it's commonly known today, is anything particular to the 20th century. Mm. Artists have been doing this, at least in the Western tradition, forever. And in fact, it's almost inevitable that as one apprentices in the arts, that is, as one enters the practice of study with a master, whoever it may be, and wherever that may be, conservatory or privately or in another part of the world, you inevitably receive some information and some inspiration, hopefully, from this person who's presumably dedicated their life to the art. And without knowing it sometimes, are simply influenced by this person. So this is the first stage of appropriation. Your study is a form of appropriation. That is your entry into the practice of essentially making useless artifacts. And I say useless because the initial part of artistic practice is generally not concerned with financial gain. That changes very rapidly sometimes, but immediately that isn't the case. To come more directly to your question about appropriation or borrowing, and what I've now morphed into this concept of this hideous euphemism, which has been, you know, just landed on us out of nowhere, called extraordinary renderings by the State Department of the United States. This piece of political poetry is very appropriate to my work because I take sounds from one place and sometimes secretly and sometimes semi-secretly and sometimes even openly put them in other places, in other collections of sounds. And so this practice of mine, which began essentially in the middle 60s with my going around with a tape recorder and recording every aspect, every sound of everything that I thought was interesting audibly around me, has now exploded into a megalomaniac gathering of all of the sounds of the world that I find interesting and putting them on this keyboard and creating spontaneously new objects which are restructurings of all of these sequestered sounds.
Mm-hmm. No, it's great to finally hear somebody talk about the artifact sort of in its static or its sort of left form as essentially useless in a certain sense, just because it's this is something that's we've done a lot of, Gene and I have done a lot of talking about in terms of the mode of creativity and how we still today, despite so much of the philosophical and critical and practice-based revolutions of the, or if you call them revolutions of the 20th century, we still exist in this kind of weird 19th century framework when we look at artistic creation that thinks about it as this kind of... It's almost Coleridgean genius, where there is such a thing as the new, the thing that kind of springs forth from the mind of the artist, that is wholly new and wholly, you know, sort of fresh in the world, and that to suggest something to the contrary is somewhat heretical or even distasteful or disrespectful of the artist, which has always struck me as a really bizarre kind of set of values and notions to operate under, because isn't it patently clear that all we're doing is making new connections, and I don't mean to belittle it by saying all we're doing, but we're doing in the world of the arts is creating new connections and associations between the vast realm of sort of flotsam and jetsam of artistic history. There's these sort of this detritus, if you will, of the history of art and expression, even with our own work. And I wondered how that operates. We were just talking about Robin Rambeau, Scanner, a British sound artist, digital artist, installation artist, whose work is also very self-referential. He'll take pieces and tear them apart and re-put them together later. So he's even sort of doing this operation on his own work, the own sort of artifacts, his own artifacts that he's created in his own past.
Absolutely.
And you know, wanted to see what you had to say about that, sort of within the trajectory of your own work.
Well, that's very simple. That's very simple.
Yeah.
A composer. As we think of a composer, I mean, I'm a composer. It's an old-fashioned concept, but I compose music. Composing is nothing. It's just sort of a form of sonic bricklaying. You just take bricks, and they happen to be made of sound, and you build walls. You build structures with these things. And this art, this practice is... essentially, it takes place in a kind of a single euphoric blitz early in life. You suddenly feel, my God, I can make music, I can compose. And everything after that is always the same piece. You're always making the same composition over and over and over again. And while people like to think of themselves as going through different periods, you could think of anybody, you know, from early Beethoven to the late Beethoven, but it's always Beethoven. And, you know, early Xenakis to late Xenakis, or Ligeti or Stravinsky or whoever. The identity of the practice, of the gesture, of the way of thinking sonically and making these things called compositions, is always the same.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, as I say, the composer, I don't know, perhaps even more so the visual artist, who constantly repeats over and over and over, much more than the composer, because composition takes a long time. It takes lots of time, and just to make these pieces. But in painting, painters who are obsessive characters, they work basically a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They're constantly, they're always painting the same thing. You look at these classic museum shows of a Picasso or a Braque or Monet or Matisse or the classic modernists, and you just see reams of work, reams and reams and reams and reams. They sit there and sketch and then paint and then watercolor and then oils and over the same theme, the same flowers, the same still life, the same scene, over and over, sometimes for a lifetime.
Mm.
And composers basically do that, but they do a lot less of it because it's much harder to generate music on paper.
Well, picking up though on a, sorry, I don't want
to. So no, go ahead.
But picking up on the realm of sort of the visual and the spatial, since you referenced it there, to what degree, or it's kind of two questions maybe. To what degree does sight and space itself become an artifact within that composition? I mean, I think in the music world, we're always thinking about sort of music abstracted. Ironically, we think about it abstracted from space very frequently, that it's either a score on paper or once it's been captured electronically, it's kind of a sound we can carry around with us as you do in your keyboard.
Mm.
But I just know a lot of your work is also dealt in site-specific installation.
Absolutely.
And, you know, how do you sort of go back and forth between those worlds, or are indeed we engaged in a site-specific piece this evening for this space of the gallery? And could you talk a little bit about that in terms of the realm, the non-musical or very perhaps profoundly musical realm of space?
Well, in fact, it is profoundly musical because the one thing that's generally not taught in the study of composition, music composition today, is the actual spatial essence of music. And as long as people are convinced that the entire process is some sort of a mental gymnastics to get these sonic structures on paper or on any other form medium that we have today, people until very recently have been in denial about the essential spatial dimension of sound. Even in a concert hall, I mean, there have been debates and problems, and halls had to be acoustically redesigned and so on. But when I was growing up in Providence, everyone would say, well, nothing ever will ever top the sound of Symphony Hall in Boston. This rather old, I believe it's an 18th century structure that seems to have some magic acoustics that are absolutely brilliant for the symphonic sound of a big orchestra. Today, as in my own experience, right here in Philadelphia, in the mid '80s, or was it late '80s? I forget exactly the exact date. I did a concert with live ship horns on the Delaware River, right here at the port, and for a New Music America festival. And this was a consequence of my own research and own needs to go from recorded sound, that is the recorded artifact, to the real thing,
mm-hmm.
that is to actually create a concert with real ship horns on real water in a
mm-hmm.
real port with sound moving across large distances and all the consequences of weather and atmosphere and temperature and so on that would affect those sound waves. So I deal in that very, very directly, and as a composer, still write music on paper,
mm-hmm.
still create false illusions, as I will tonight, from the keyboard, and actually create a new musical theater in ports, rivers, quarries, trees, parks, and all kinds of spaces that are, to me, theatrically and sonically interesting.
Mm-hmm. So you're really engaged in the sort of interconvertibility of those of the world.
Absolutely. So to me, really the world is a potential music hall.
Right.
Simple as that.
And that gets, I would imagine, into the purely conceptual as well. I mean, I was just reading the note that you wrote for this piece tonight, which is both references what I gather are real journeys, but also imaginary journeys.
Absolutely.
And in terms of space, you know, theoretical space, conceptual space.
Right.
And that has a sort of relationship to this very real world of sound that we're going to hear tonight.
So absolutely.
It's perhaps not just the virtual and the real, but also the sort of imaginary as well. So
it's mostly imaginary.
It's mostly the imaginary.
And I might add, this is a good juncture to add an element, a simple idea that I've been talking here about composition. But there's two kinds of composition. There's composition in deferred time, where you sit and struggle and think of these sounds and write these things down and this is the traditional and much admired form of music making that has developed over the last 1,000+ years in the European tradition. Alongside of that, not only in Europe, but in other countries around the world, and especially in our own time, there's developed a form of composition which is spontaneous composition, which is making music in the moment, al fresco, as it were. And this is what's going to happen tonight. It's pure composition, but I didn't write it yet. It's written only as you hear it. And this form of music making, sometimes called improvisation, or I like to call it spontaneous music making, is in fact no easy job. It's not something that you just sit down and do. It takes a lifetime of study and practice, just as much as the other form of composition.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Did you want to open up to questions? I also don't want to. I don't know what the nature of the conversation. I don't wear a watch.
It's 10 to. It's almost.
10
yeah,
to 8.
Yeah, something like that.
10 to 8.
Well, we could ask if someone has a question. Otherwise, we could also continue with a few more questions for Alvin. So you might have questions afterwards rather than right now.
We could open things up. Just interrupt.
Sure.
Yes.
You say your music isn't written yet, but will it ever be written?
Well, that's a lie, actually. But the music is written, because just like the first composition I ever made, it's the same seeds that I use here that I would in any compositional process.
I guess I'm asking, is it repeatable?
It's repeatable, yes, in two ways. One is by recording what I do and then playing it back. And secondly, I would say quasi-repeatable, because even though I will do certain things this evening, if they happen in a certain way, I'm bound to do them again and again, because I'll like them, and I want to keep them. So. An entire improvisation may not be identically note for note, sound for sound, repeatable. And incidentally, the sounds I'm using here are not necessarily tones, although sometimes they may be. They're mostly the sounds of animals, people, objects, machines, places, events, some private, some public. All kinds of things. So it's in a way, it's my inner narrative, and it's a very personal history. What's on under these keys? You could come up later and play them for yourself, but you might not feel at home with them. But if you put your favorite sounds down there, then you'd be making your music. Yes?
What kind of guidelines or structure, if any, do you give to the musicians while
they
improvise?
To the musicians? Well, at first, I'm going to be playing a solo, so there are no... I'm my own boss, and I only take instructions from higher powers. So afterwards, there will be a collective improvisation. I'll be performing with several musicians who I've never met before. And they haven't met me, except in this moment. But we're going to make music together spontaneously because we speak the same language.
So do you accept responsibility for what happens tonight, or is that up to the higher power?
No, absolutely. Every bit of it. The responsibility is, of course, this is in music making, as in all the arts, you have to absolutely... accept the responsibility of for everything that you put out there.
Do you consider the this practice of appropriation, borrowing, thievery, however you want to cast it? do you consider that and wield that with sort of a critical intent? There's been much talk over the last decades. I'm thinking about John Oswald and his
yep.
work that's very much politicized and almost, he glorifies the sort of sometimes literal criminality of what he's doing to make a point about the status of sound, the status of music, ownership, et cetera, some of the things that you could consider to be an extension, a very sort of legal and political,
yep.
social extension of a lot of Cage's ideas and some of those.
Exactly.
So, could you talk a little bit about that? About sort of because you've opened the political door with this
well,
issue here.
there's no
so,
question
yeah.
about it, and I'm glad you brought this question up because I think it's very relevant to life in our digital times. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make one small point. Thaddeus mentioned Cage's views and concept, which I would like to clarify a little bit about. In the early 50s already, over a half a century ago, Cage, in his supreme imagination, began to understand that all sound, anything audible is potential music. This has had enormous consequences, sometimes devastating, sometimes incredibly illuminating for everything that came after it, and I'm one of them. So to understand that and to practice that is to actually embrace all sound, all accident, anything that happens from a car crash out there to this heating system which is in our face right now. These sounds in Cage's view, and very radically, almost religiously, were considered music. Now I lost the thread after having done this detour.
Well, I was kind of asking about the sort of critical or political
ramifications. Oh yes, right,
of
right,
that.
Okay, right. Very important because the. Stealing is no joke. My music has been stolen. It's all over the internet now. I have no control over my own work anymore. On the other hand, I steal all the time, but I steal with love. And there's a little bit of difference here. So when you steal lovingly, the crime may be a little... a little less serious. But in any case, what I'm saying is tonight there will be, you might hear Maria Callas's voice. You might hear Pavarotti's voice. You'll certainly hear John Cage's voice a lot. You'll hear the Beastie Boys. You'll hear Tchaikovsky. You'll hear all kinds of stuff we'll have. Luciano Berio is a beautiful one chord, one note of the beginning of a wonderful piece by Berio, which I love, and so on and so forth. So there's tons of references and referential materials. Now, I have no right to use those. By law, I'm an outlaw. I'm a total outlaw. But in our time, in these digital times, this scourge that we have by being able to download, take, cut, paste instantaneously musics and sounds from any place on the planet, made at any time in human memory, and available at any time, day or night, nonstop, all the time. This is an extraordinary new paradigm that we're living in musically. This has never happened before. Beethoven could not hear the music of Hildegard von Bingen. There may have been scores, but not even. And Monteverdi certainly was not able to hear Wagner's music because he was already dead. But today, these things, everything is possible. With sound, sound suddenly belongs to everybody. And there's suddenly such a insane kind of jubilee. There's an explosion of and also a philosophical explosion as well, because much to the chagrin of composers like myself, who are old-fashioned author's rights advocates. But nonetheless, the means that we do have today enable some people to think that music is absolutely free, just like the air we breathe. So, from that perspective, and I don't want to go into the legal matters because I'm not qualified to talk about that. But there is a huge conflict of interest, especially between individuals, composers like myself, who still believe that I should receive payment for the use of my works. And especially to the industrial makers of music, that is the record companies and record and concert producers on a big scale, who must protect their works. So for example, you can't go into a concert hall and record or take pictures today, but people still do, and there's no way to stop that. In any case, it's a big problem, but we're muddling through.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about it. Using the word lovingly. I was at a legal conference a couple years ago that was sponsored by NARIS, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, and they were trying to. At one point, a sort of old question came up: why are people so prone to steal, to download from the internet, to copy discs, to copy DVDs? At home, which is, you know, everybody logically would think is, well, outright theft or plagiarism, if you will, of a certain kind. And why does that seem so acceptable when you do it at home? And it really, the studies psychologically and otherwise coming back to them said that it really has to do with the sort of domestic context of theft, that when it's sort of domesticated, if you will, as opposed to being more feral and sort of out there in the outside world, it has this a very different sort of moral and sort of ethical context to it. And so to sit at your computer at home and download something is not the same as breaking into somebody else's house and stealing their china. Whereas the sort of hypothesis on the table was there really nothing, there's no difference between the two legally at a certain level. But we would not think twice. We'd think twice about the latter, hopefully, but perhaps not about the former. And that was a very interesting sort of context. And it really speaks to the intention of what that is. I mean, when you're talking about a fundamentally aesthetic or an artistic tension, intention behind that borrowing, that's been an accepted practice for hundreds of years now, to
Absolutely.
A certain degree. And so we now see the sort of the technological metastasization of that very old practice and what that means legally and economically, which is quite significant. And I think it's interesting that now, at our position today, this has become this hotbed issue, whereas it's not, you know, it's been sort of either a domestic or an artistic practice that's very accepted in our society for so long. So it's an interesting sort of thing to think about.
I wanted to follow on from that, Elvin. Like, what would you imagine to be a compromise between those two positions that you yourself occupy? You know, as someone who wants to and does use this material, but also as a composer who wants some semblance of protection for your interests. I mean, where do you see those things squaring against themselves?
This is a question that I'm still struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, my work takes place in a very, very narrow economic field. It's not only narrow, it's on the edges of the large musical punch bowl that everyone is
swimming
in. So I'm happy to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm there by choice and delighted and have been able to lead a happily creative life in that area. But when I'm told that I shouldn't adhere to the conventions and the demands of international law, namely the receiving and subscribing to monies which are collected by various collection agencies around the world for the broadcast, the live use, or any other use of my music, I naturally get upset, because this isn't a divine right by any means, but these conventions are there. They do work.
Mm-hmm.
They work much more, let's say, for Michael Jackson than they do for me.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, they work for everyone at some level. And whatever that source of income may be, especially in our somewhat marginalized world, it's important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, because my work does sometimes borrow lovingly from other people's music...
lovingly.
I have to be careful about that. I cannot publish those works easily. I can perform them in this room, but I cannot bring them out on record, because that is not right. And that makes a record company, myself, if I do it privately, or a legal company, liable to damages or queries from the people who I'm using. If Pavarotti would one day say, that guy Curran has used my voice too many times, and that those 3 seconds of my high C are mine, he's absolutely right. There's no question of that. And I shouldn't be doing that. Yes?
This just brings to mind for me,
Sometimes their stints are more tenacious
than
they are.
I think legally you're not stealing it when they're dead. And then there are, of course, conventions such as statute of limitations and all kinds of things, but it isn't so much a question of dead, alive, or limitations or not. I'm working in a grand postmodern tradition. I'll use that word even though it isn't my favorite, but it does describe a practice, a mindset, a time, which is our time right now and has been for the last 70 years or so, where the collision and the speed of many different ideas, sounds, cultures, available thoughts and practices are just in this amazing vortex of generative possibility. And this is where I'm working from. I have no idea where it's leading. I don't even know how I got there. I can't tell you that. I mean, if I started off with a microphone recording some dripping water in my sink, that innocent act, which led to some beautiful scores that I made early on, has now led to the kinds of things that I'll be doing pretty soon here. So, yes?
Well, you're not stealing lovingly. You're promoting people's work.
Well, this is the loving part.
Right.
Yeah, but it's kind of like a scholarly work. I mean,
yeah, it's a quotation.
It's a quotation.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
You're not publishing. You're not making money by publishing it.
So. Well, if I were to publish it,
and
then you get in trouble.
Yeah.
There you go. But I would never deny that those sounds were mine. I would always say where they come from, and always have. Yes. Planet.
And you also talk about the idea of spontaneous composition.
Right.
And so as a person, as someone who is developing from seeds with the world around you in this age, do you feel that there are any specific responsibilities that you felt as a part of that process?
I'll tell you, the answer is yes and no. Because that process happened so fast in my lifetime. As I said, moving from innocent dripping water in my sink to the marvels of digital technology today, that I contemplate this every day and in every action and in every way. And I honestly, that's great. And I honestly can't say that I have the answer to the question, because in my own experience, which contains the question, I've lived a good deal of that, and am still finding out the consequences and the meanings.
How are we doing?
Can you say something more about being responsible? Because you said, of course, you're 100% responsible for what you produce. Many artists, you know, come to the point where they feel part of a grand tradition, they're being used by the grand tradition or by a muse or whatever to express something greater than yourself. So there's always that sort of two sides of the creative act, and I wonder where you fall on that.
I like the question, I don't know if I really understand it. I don't know if I live that in the same way that that you're thinking. I'm not trying to be evasive, but I do have some doubts about living in the grand tradition, even though I do. There's no question in my life that I owe everything musically to a very powerful and almost overwhelmingly powerful tradition of European music making. There's no question about that. I refer to it constantly. I think of it a lot. I play it sometimes. And I ponder it a lot. But that me and Beethoven want to have a showdown, no, never. I don't come from that school.
You don't feel, oh, so
good. Well, no. I'm just saying I don't come from there. And this isn't because I've renounced the great symphonic tradition, the operatic tradition, the chamber music tradition from which I came, because I really did come from there. But I found some other marvels along the way. John Cage was one of them. Another was Conlon Nancarrow and Harry Parch. I don't know if you know all of their musics. Another was Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk. Others were from more recent times. I could go on just naming endless people who don't necessarily refer directly to the grand tradition. And that would include even some very special composers, Cage among them, an Italian rebel composer, as it were, Giacinto Scelsi, who wrote music on one note for most of his life. And, well, he wrote music on one note because he understood from Indian music that's all you have to know. So this inspired him so much that he wrote these very, very unusual pieces. And they're now the cat's pajamas in a lot of new music scenes. So there are many, many different tides and pulls and tendencies and almost traditions, even like ones that I myself had some part in forming by creating musics first with a closed group of people who renounced even playing on ordinary instruments. And decided at some point in the furor of the utopian 1968 times that everybody could play, and we invited whole publics to play, and we got into a great deal of trouble doing that. So, but these were experiments that happened, and the consequences led to some very interesting ideas and practices, which I maintain to this very day. I think I answered, might have answered your question.
Well, it's the situation that you don't feel fettered. I mean, you address this a little bit in your writing on common practice and this notion of the fact that for Beethoven to break loose from Haydn, you know, was a very painful and arduous thing,
a big deal. Yeah.
Whereas it would almost be inconceivable, at least just, you know, to me sitting here at this time, to think of an artist working today feeling that sense of being fettered by a sense of common practice, because it's almost omnipractice. It's so diversified and so wildly,
absolutely,
unfettered and unbounded in its scope that
it's terrifying.
It's almost the reverse. The reverse happens. You can't figure out where to start or what you're coming from and where you're going to, because it's so diversified. But it's a very different. It's certainly not the same kind of fetteredness that you would
absolutely
think.
I have a phrase for this, which is, in fact, I just lectured at Brown University the other day, and I bewildered people by using the phrase, the new common practice.
Right.
And the new common practice is precisely what you're describing.
Yes.
That absolute, mindless, and terrifying freedom that we all have now to make music any way we want, with anything, with anybody, anywhere. This is something new.
unser guter Kaspar ist tot, heiliger Bimbam, Kaspar ist tot. Weh, 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 unser guter Kaspar ist tot, heiliger Bimbam, Kaspar ist tot. Weh, 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 unser guter Kaspar ist tot, heiliger Bimbam, Kaspar ist tot. Weh, 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 unser guter Kaspar ist tot, heiliger Bimbam, Kaspar ist tot. Weh, 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 unser guter Kaspar ist tot, heiliger Bimbam, Kaspar ist tot. Weh, 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 unser guter Kaspar ist tot.
Mm-hmm.